This is Eagle 1490 AM WLCX La Crosse and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packard. The White House says President Trump will make a decision on potential U.S. strikes on Iran within the next 2 weeks, holding out hope for a diplomatic solution. Meanwhile, cracks in the Iron Dome, more and more missiles coming from Iran are breaking through Israel's defenses. ABC's Ian Pannell is in Tel Aviv.
Many Israelis woke up to the sound of sirens and then this intense barrage of ballistic missiles from Iran. Many of them landing here in Tel Aviv, but also others landing down in the south near the city of Be'er Sheva. And in particular, a hospital down there took a direct hit.
Dozens of federal agents in masks and tactical gear were seen today outside the gates of Dodger Stadium in Los Angeles. That prompted a response from protesters. ICE says they requested permission to stage in the parking lot. The Dodgers say that request was denied. Severe thunderstorms in the Northeast this evening, lightning and heavy rain along the I-95 corridor. Hundreds of thousands without power at this hour. This is ABC News.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
The Brewers win. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with Sports Baseball. A great day today at Wrigley Field where the wind was blowing out and the Brewers taking advantage. An 8-7 win from Milwaukee over the Cubs at the friendly confines. Three home runs today by the crew. Rhys Hoskins, Caleb Durbin, and Isaac Collins getting his fourth home run of the season. Drama in the ninth. Closer Trevor McGill on the mound and some very poor calls on some pitches that should have been called strikes. Pat Murphy visibly upset from the dugout. McGill managed to get out of the inning with one strikeout and getting the Cubs' Seiya Suzuki to hit into a double play. Trevor McGill with his 16th save of the season. Pat Murphy after the win.
Great opportunity for our young guys to then face the great Cubs team coming back and breathing down our necks right to the very end. So it gets pretty emotional.
What did you think of the way Trevor specifically responded?
I thought Trevor's been great, man. This guy's underrated. Trevor's been great.
Up next, the Brewers head to Minnesota for a weekend series against the Twins with Sports on Mike Clemens.
A game without a crowd is just a scrimmage. A performance without an audience is just a rehearsal. Without your presence, high school sports and the performing arts aren't possible. Ensure that these essential extracurricular activities continue to enrich the lives of students in Wisconsin. Purchase a ticket to your local high school's game or performance.
This message presented by the WIAA and the Wisconsin Athletic Directors Association.
Eagle 1490 AM.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. Crypto, baby, crypto. Yeah, they passed the Genius Act, which stands for Guiding and Establishing National Innovation for U.S. Stable Coins Act, creating a legal framework, a legal backing for digital assets. They claim it's going to be pegged to to fixed assets like the U.S. dollar. I'm not 100% sure what that is. It's going to set some rules on how they're issued, what reserves need to be done, and some oversight. And you go, sounds like a good thing. And I'm like, I'm not so sure. Given the fact that I think crypto is a bad idea, I think digital currency, not a great idea, but I think it's already gone. There's a generation coming who is okay with digital currency, okay with having everything that you do tracked. This is one of those places where I thought my Republican friends would be like, no. I'm not in favor of having everything I do watched and surveilled, not just by government, but by private corporations. But I digress. The vote 68-30 in the Senate. This will be, as I said, the first piece of legislation to establish rules that will create and regulate what they're calling stable coins. I guess we're changing that a little bit. And look, a number of Democrats, some very disappointing, because I don't think I would have voted for this for a bunch of reasons. But some of your more progressive Democrats, and there were a number of them, I believe 18 as a whole, two Republicans voted against it. And some of the names, you know, kind of got me. Booker from New Jersey, Warnock and Ossoff from Georgia. I wasn't surprised with Fetterman, because Fetterman has kind of gone that direction. But Gallego in Arizona, Gildebrand, I get. But Padilla and Schiff in California after what happened to Padilla, I don't know. Because this is a major win for Trump. Because understand, you know, he's Mr. Crypto now. And you go, well, what is crypto? And that's the thing, because most of us don't know what this is. And the people that I know who've dabbled in it, they all come back to me with it's a Ponzi scheme. If you get in early enough, you're going to be okay. But if you're going to be the guy left holding the bag at the end, you're kind of going to get screwed. Now, I've got my libertarian friends who are saying that, you know, this is the end of the dollar. We're not going to use paper money anymore. We're going to digitize everything. We're going to freedom. Because it's going to be true money. And I'm like, I'm not quite sure how you get to that. Considering, I'm not sure how it's created. What backs it? Now, some would argue that this legislation helps back some of that. And my mind goes, do we really want to be backing something this dangerous? Again, I keep going back to Alan Greenspan after the collapse of our economy in 2008, talking about, you know, when they did away with Glass-Steagall and allowed, you know, Wall Street to gamble and do all of their very technical financial instruments, and his belief that they were too technical for government to regulate. And my argument would have been, if they're that technical, maybe we shouldn't have them. Maybe you shouldn't be playing with dynamite. And, you know, his only response to when it all went belly up was that, well, I didn't think people would do that. Yeah. So this is my problem with this crypto. This is an example, in my view, of the wealthy getting wealthier and the poor and the working stiff getting stuck again. Because what we know about crypto is that we know that the crypto bros and the crypto oligarchs are spending enormous amounts of money. In 2024, the crypto super PAC, about $120 million that supported candidates that support the industry. And I think that paid off in looking at the vote, especially with a number of Democrats. We are seeing a group who are going to be really in charge of our instrument of transactions. And, you know, you go back to the scandal with FTX, and I'm not comfortable with it. And to have this vote, especially, you know, when you're looking at the number of, you know, stories about cryptocurrency being used by foreign actors to influence elections, the money laundering, there's just so much. Now, you could go, but here's the thing. You know, we're regulating some of that. We're going to get the bad actors. And I don't know. I don't know, because here's my problem. I know what I do know is cryptocurrency addresses, the 0.01% control over 50%, 58% of all Bitcoin. The 0.023% of all wallet addresses are held by 50%, hold 50% of Bitcoin wealth. So what we have is a massive consolidation of wealth globally. And now you've got these new financial elites who can manipulate markets. They can do all kinds of things. Will this regulation, will this matter? I'm told maybe, but, you know, here's the thing. We've seen these rug pull schemes. We've seen the pump and dump schemes. We've seen this stuff with, you know, 98.5% of meme back tokens being disposed of before they reach exchanges. That should worry the latecomers, because they're the ones who get stuck. And when I hear that, I think of Donald Trump. Because remember, his meme coin, it launched on January 18th, just 2 days before he took office. It's lost more than half its value in 5 months. So what does that mean? That means he fleeced the flock. And you knew that was going to happen. You knew it was going to happen. And oh, by the way, did I mention that, you know, the poor stiffs who are going to get stuck with this are working people? And that Trump has now allowed pension funds? Yeah. Has now allowed pension funds to invest in this stuff. So you can go and look, you know, the Democrats were just trying to regulate and they got the best regulations they could. And I'm going, I'm sorry, not seeing it. I'm not seeing a Republican Party willing to regulate. Remember, these are the deregulation people. These are the Wild West people. These are the get government out of your life people. And oh, by the way, some of the things that I have seen so far is from my libertarian friends, this is a way to undermine the Fed. And whether you're a fan of the Fed or not, are you okay with this gamble to undermine what they do? And are you okay with the potential of a global currency? Now, we can make arguments all day whether that's good or bad, whether it's going to help or hurt China, whether it's going to help or hurt us. But I keep coming back to this pit of my stomach instinct that is going to be working people right now who end up getting taken to the cleaners. That the wealthy, the elites, our new crypto whales, they're going to do very, very well. Thank you very much. And it's going to be you and me who get screwed. So I got problems with Democrats today, or at least the 18 that voted for this. I want to hear your thoughts. You okay with this? Is this a good idea? Do you think the Genius Act was a work of genius? Or like me, are you really cautious? And on the side of against, given the reality of what we've seen thus far. I want to hear your thoughts. Quick break, right back.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So we're finding out more and more about the Senate nightmare bill. And look, when you thought you couldn't get any worse, the Senate stepped in and said, yeah, hold our beer. We can do better. We can make it worse. And here to share some thoughts on, well, what more we are learning out of the Senate over this big, beautiful nightmare. I've asked my friend Alex Lawson to come share some thoughts. Alex is the executive director of Social Security Works. You can check out their website, socialsecurityworks.org. Alex, thanks for taking time for us.
Always. It's my pleasure, for sure.
So where are we at this moment? I know there's been a lot of talk. There's a lot of back and forth. There's a lot of chaos, if you will, around this. What are we knowing at this moment?
I went in hoping that the Senate would play the traditional role of moderating a bill that comes out of the House. That's, you know,
the upper chamber,
generally how it works, right? Or is supposed to work. The House, you know, puts in all the red meat, and then the Senate are supposed to be wiser or something like that.
Yeah, the rages of the people in the House, and then the adults in the Senate are supposed to help. I got it.
But they made everything worse. So, like, you know, the hospital associations were saying, and it's a complicated policy on purpose, you know, but this provider tax that you're talking about, what that means is hospitals will close, right? So if you increase this, you know, more hospitals are going to close, especially in rural areas, but nowhere is safe. And that's exactly what the Senate did. They just hiked that up. They cut deeper into Medicaid, right? So people lose their health care. We're still talking about 16 million because the CBO hasn't rerun their numbers yet. But, you know, for what it looks like is everything is worse. So it'll be even more people. And it's already caused them political, you know, blowback. But what I'm hearing from people who definitely know what they're talking about is that industry has been told that, you know, there's two groups of Republicans who they have to worry about. And it's, you know, the sort of deficit hawk type people and the moderates. And they just, this is the one that says the moderates are going to get rolled. We don't have to worry about them. And, you know, we're more worried about losing votes from, you know, supposedly the right, even with the deeper cuts, it does, you know, it's still a massive increase in debt by stopping, by just giving enormous trillions of dollars in tax handouts to billionaires. I don't want to do an aside, I have to for a second, but the magnitude of this is the handouts are as big. You know, we've been fighting on the and we'll return to this, the shortfall in the trust fund of Social Security. And they say it is, oh, it's going bankrupt. And it's not going bankrupt. It literally can't go bankrupt. But it's just about billionaires not paying their fair share. And so we just have to actually deal with that issue, make them pay the same rate as the rest of us. It's the same size as the handout to billionaires, right? So for decades, they've agonized over this as like the largest thing in, and now you see how easy it is when it goes the other way, when it's taking money from us and giving it to them. But that's where we are.
Yeah, but hasn't that been, you know, the MO of the Republicans and a number of Democrats pretty much our entire political lifetime? I mean, all of these tax cuts have been paid for by, you know, diminished opportunities for working people, less healthcare, less education, less infrastructure, less for working people, more for the billionaire class we've created. And we don't even get trading cards or anything to pick our favorites.
It's true. And now, it is the way it works. And they have been, rolling the moderates is I understand why they're thinking that. The margins are incredibly tight though. And I don't think we should forget that because it's smaller in the House still. It's three in the House. They right. can only lose three in the House. And the House has already said that the Medicaid cuts, which is basically the roll the moderate side, right? Like make the you take more from people to give in, because they've kept most of the tax handouts the same, right? Enormous. And then they're saying, okay, we'll just cut people's benefits and healthcare more to pay for it and, pay for it. And that's what the Senate has come out with. I think there's still a distance to be had. And I think there is some theater involved here because right now, you know, the cuts that they did to hospitals, it basically removes rural hospitals as a concept in this country. There will be no more rural hospitals. You know, that's not actually far off because they're already, we're in the middle of a rural hospital collapse already.
Right.
We're in Eau Claire, Wisconsin on Friday. We have three events at hospitals and two of the hospitals already closed. This is the north of Wisconsin because rural hospitals are already closing across the country. But this kicks out the last thing they had going for them is Medicaid. And this just kicks that out from under them. So rural hospitals are going down.
Yeah. And look, in a lot of those communities, in a lot of these rural, small rural communities, the hospital is like the main driver of employment, let alone the main driver of healthcare. So not only are you going to lose your healthcare, you're going to lose the main driver of your economy, which means the snowball effect of evil just explodes.
It does. So what I expect them to do is to, in the middle of the Senate negotiation, they'll try to throw, you know, it's arterial what they've done to the hospital industry. It's like the magnitude is really hard to fathom. And they'll come back and they'll say like, oh yeah, well, here's a $5 million rural healthcare retraining program, right? Or something like that. And it'll be designed to give cover to Holly, Collins, Murkowski, and send it back to the House. I don't think that it gets much more complicated in the House. We probably should talk about that when we get there. I do think, you know, we're going to fight it every step of the way, but it's feeling like the fix is in the Senate, like they actually know what they can get across the finish line. And there's some theater going on, but also at the same time in Washington, D.C., I've always been served well by my number one rule. It's always Veep. It's never House of Cards. And so we are going to keep fighting. And we didn't think we could stop Trump care in Trump 1.0, but it was the famous thumbs down. And so we'll just keep fighting it in the Senate, pointing out that I do think that the biggest problem is still by far and away that people don't understand what's in the bill, because the Republicans lied about, there's no Medicaid cuts in there. And a lot of people don't know that they're on a program that has a different name, but is actually Medicaid.
No, this is the part that, and I'm glad you hit this because, a number of years ago, I met a woman who, just in passing conversation, we had this class conversation. And she firmly believed she was in the middle class, back 15 years ago, making, $16,000 a year. And her definition of why she was in the middle class and not like a lower version of it is because she didn't take anything from the government. I don't get anything from the government without understanding that the school lunch program that her kids got were part of the government, that the earned income tax credit that she got in her taxes at the end of the year were part of a government program, that all of these things. So it's interesting that a lot of us get some things here and there that are on the chopping block potentially that we didn't even know really was a government program.
Yeah, I actually think that that's a huge part of, and it is a part of the billionaire's design is to actually make people ashamed of getting things that are ours, that we've earned and we've built, and blaming ourselves for a system that is not broken. It is built to be extractive. It's working at what it's doing, which is extracting wealth from working people by any means they can find. And they've financialized, meaning extracting wealth from every aspect of our lives and our deaths, our health, just every single part of our lives, our attention, our data, everything. They're just extracting money from it. And that's what this is. The hospital infrastructure, the health system infrastructure, they're just going to suck money out of it. People will die. It's 51,000 people per year. That's the estimate from the whole proposal. Will die. That's 51,000 people a year are going to die. That's where the tax handouts come from. It's as simple as that. The tax handouts are based on stealing people's health and in tens of thousands a year, their lives. That's the just deeply immoral argument that we find ourselves in.
It's almost a Vietnam War every year.
I mean, magnitude is mind-boggling. And I think, I've said this, I think you talk about it, I might have stolen it from you, but the decency trap has a lot to do with this. The American people are far and wide very decent. They don't believe that it could be that bad. They're like, oh, I don't think it's that bad, right? Like, my hospital will probably be fine. I don't live in a rural area. And you're like, okay, well, you remember how I said people are going to be driving 4 miles to get there, 4 hours to get their care, and in emergency situations, that's going to be a matter of life and death. Well, also, people who are driving 4 hours, they're coming to your hospital if it's still open. right? So even if your hospital doesn't close, it's going to be overflowing with people from hospitals that have closed. There's nowhere that doesn't get hit by this. There's no dodging, unless you're a billionaire, the quality of your healthcare goes down. And I mean, like,
and the costs are going to go up.
And exactly. And that's the money. You're like, that translates into money for rich people. That's how the system works.
And this is where I go back to what you said a moment ago. The system is working exactly the way it's intended. It's about redistribution, a massive redistribution of wealth from people who work for a living to people who shuffle money from one pocket to the other. And you talked a moment ago about deserved. And look, we've earned Social Security. We've paid into Medicare. We've paid into these programs. And now I understand a new number has come out. Evidently, we're somewhere in going to run out of money in what, 2033 to pay all of the benefits, and I guess what, 77% thereon, is that right?
Right. What we're talking about, it's important to always note, there's no way Social Security can go bankrupt, right? That's a lie. The Washington Post pushes that every year, you know, running out of money. And that really scares people because, you know, this is what tens of millions of people live on, Social Security, just Social Security, or over 90% of their income. It is a massive benefit cut. If we do nothing, that's like 8 years. And it's not a crisis. Like I said, you see how fast Congress can move to address something this big of the same exact magnitude. It's just when it's a handout to when it's upward and it's giving to the billionaire class. But when we're saying the billionaires should just pay the same rate as everyone else, which is the solution to this whole thing. And so, you know, we have 8 years to make billionaires pay the same rate into Social Security that the rest of us do. And that is going to be a large fight.
Yeah, but aren't we heading, Alex? Aren't we heading to a point where it's almost already too late? I mean, is there a point where you go, they held it off long enough where these cuts are going to happen? Maybe a smaller number, even if you get what you ask for.
I don't think so. I think that Social Security is still has a magically powerful constituency. You know, the billionaires don't always win. Sometimes it seems like they do, they're also overreaching like nobody's business. So I will just say, you know, I think a lot of this is also people have heard for years, the Republicans are going to do this, and this terrible thing will happen. Healthcare, hospitals are going to close. And then we beat them. And then, right, the Republicans don't do that. And then people are like, oh, it didn't even happen. And you're like, that's because we fought it. Yeah. We fought it and won. And I'm not conceding and that they're going to win.
This is where I want to end this because, you know, I get all the time, you know, the Democrats have left the working class and the Democrats are you blame Republicans for everything. I go, yeah, because most of the bad ideas that have harmed the working class in my lifetime have emanated out of the Republican Party and their think tanks and their billionaire backing. Have Democrats been perfect? Have they been perfect? No, not even close. They could have done an awful lot more. But in the I got two choice world, the Democrats are still a whole heck of a lot better off for us than the Republican policy.
Absolutely. It's really clear, right? I mean, it's the billionaires are the ones who are destroying working class jobs, right? It's not immigrants coming over the border who are taking our jobs. It's billionaires taking our jobs and sending them over the border. That's the truth. And billionaires are always going to be the problem. And it's just not changed. And the Democrats have tons of problems. They've got their own billionaire problem, right? Like we're not saying they're perfect. They're far from perfect. But the Republicans are like, it's literal. There's policies that they push where you're like, this is pure evil. Like, right. You look at it and you're like, I'm almost impressed because this is just sociopathic evil, you know? And that is pretty clear. Yeah. So we have to fight, the hospital collapse, the cuts to Medicaid. And I am hopeful. It is so enormous that I do think we can, we have a chance of stopping it in the Senate. We have a, it's a even closer margin in the House. Three votes they can lose, and they're already down one. So we have to find just two Republican House members who are like not going to vote for all the health care in their district disappearing. And, you know, we were in Miller Meek's district this morning. So I think it's possible as long as people know what's going on and understand how to raise their voices together.
No, I'm right there with you. And it's good people like you out there fighting the good fight, educating, informing, activating. I think so important. Alex Lawson, I appreciate you taking some time for me. Great talking with you.
Always my pleasure.
Alex Lawson, Executive Director of Social Security Works. You want good information about what's going on? SocialSecurityWorks.org. That's where you go. I want to hear your thoughts. Are you in a rural area concerned maybe your hospital is going to close? I know I'm in one. I'm always worried about that. Want to hear your thoughts. Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Right back.
You're listening to The Eagle, WLCX. La Crosse's home for Matt and Air on Air.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Mostly cloudy, warm, and muggy tonight with scattered showers and thunderstorms, and some could be strong with pockets of heavy rainfall, lows upper 60s. Turning partly sunny tomorrow, warm and humid with highs in the mid-80s. Extreme heat watch this weekend. Steamy highs in the mid-90s. Right now it's 78 degrees.
Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel.
The Trump administration arresting and deporting these supposed gang members without giving them due process is one of the steps to becoming an authoritarian government.
Dale, thank you so much for the call. And again, I second all of that. Bring them all back and afford them the due process that's a part of our nation, a part of this law, and a part of our tradition in administering justice.
Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel. Saturday mornings from 9 to 11.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So as I said yesterday on the program, the House Big Beautiful Nightmare Bill is bad. It's bad. Bad for Medicaid cuts, bad for people with health insurance. It's just bad for working people. It's bad. Say what it is. Somehow the Senate... Somehow the Senate said, you know, hold my beer. We're going to make Medicaid cuts worse. We're going to make things worse for poor people and, well, obviously better for rich people. And here to share some thoughts on just what this will mean for working class folk like you and me, I've asked Andrea Dukas to come talk with us. She is the Vice President of Health Policy there at the Center for American Progress. They've got a new analysis out that shows that, you know, it's going to be bad. Andrea, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, very glad to be here.
So let's start with the House bill's bad, right? How'd the Senate bill get worse?
So the House bill, like just to level set for your listeners, the House bill did a number of things to cut healthcare benefits in this country. One, it made the biggest cut to Medicaid in the program's history, and Medicaid is the form of public insurance that supports very low income, very poor people in this country and people with disabilities. It made changes to the Affordable Care Act, or it would make changes to the Affordable Care Act that would jack up premiums and out-of-pocket costs for people who buy insurance through the ACA marketplace. And it also made healthcare coverage more expensive for, and this is a little known provision, about 1.3 million people with Medicare. So these were pretty steep cuts, and the way that they got to these cuts was sort of complicated. The headline was that they would put all sorts of burdensome work requirements and paperwork requirements on Medicaid enrollees. But the Senate bill went even further, especially with respect to Medicaid. So, you know, you heard a lot of hemming and hawing from House Republicans who I think were taken a little bit aback by the pushback to the Medicaid cuts. And they said, oh, well, you know, for the work requirements, we're not going to... That's just for young guys who are sitting on the couch playing video games. Like, parents are going to be fine. We exempt them. Well, the Senate bill puts work requirements on parents. Parents who have children over the age of 14 would be subject to these same arduous, burdensome work requirements. On top of that, in the House bill, there were some changes to the Medicare program and to ACA marketplace eligibility that would limit the types of lawful immigrants that are able to access the coverage. So people with like temporary protected status, asylees, folks, again, with legal immigration status would be removed from eligibility for Medicare and Marketplace coverage. And the Senate bill applied that same limitation to Medicaid. So it went even further on Medicaid, which was shocking, honestly. The Senate bill also did a couple of other things to financially punish states that chose to expand their Medicaid programs to childless adults by limiting how much revenue they could raise to help pay for their Medicaid programs, and by limiting how much money they could reimburse the managed care organizations that administer their programs to try to increase the number of providers that accept people with Medicaid. It's pretty wild.
Well, I mean, they're trying to save money, Andrea. They're pinching the penny, they're squeezing the quarter till the eagle screams. And when I hear them talk about saving money, what they're really saying is we're going to ration care for people, and we're gonna shift responsibility onto someone else. Because look, people aren't gonna stop getting sick. People aren't gonna stop having accidents. People aren't gonna stop being disabled. And certainly in this country, people aren't gonna automatically stop being poor. So what then happens if we're taking this avenue away? What happens then?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. As you correctly note, you know, losing your insurance doesn't make your cancer diagnosis go away. It doesn't get rid of your diabetes. You're still going to need care, and you're just not going to be able to pay for it. So if you're showing up in an emergency room or in a hospital seeking care and can't pay the bill, those costs just get shifted to hospitals, right? So we did an analysis a little while back about how much of a hit in uncompensated care, so like care that hospitals aren't actually making up the cost for, what that might look like because of the bill. And we found that it was going to be something like, you know, $35-36 billion. It's just a cost shifting measure. And then for other folks, right, like, so say you need ongoing medication, you're just not going to take it. And that's why, you know, we see the very real likelihood here that when millions of people lose insurance coverage, there are going to be thousands of people who are going to get sick and die.
I would also argue that, look, you know, if you're taking this stuff away, you're going to actually make healthcare cost more, because people aren't going to go and get that preventative care.
Yes.
That comes with a lot of these things. So we're actually making the problem that much worse. And the AFL-CIO came out with a report just yesterday that said, you know, of the 179 million workers with job-based insurance, they expect premiums to soar $500 a year for each person covered. So a family of four could see an additional $2,000 in healthcare costs because of this shifting, this redistribution that's happening. As we're not paying for it through the public sector, they're gonna suck it out of we the working people to pay for this through higher premiums, because these hospitals, they got to survive.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that's just in premium costs, right? We're also expecting, because of the House bill, that there's another technical change in there that would play with the formula for how the out-of-pocket max in your job-based coverage is set. Like, that will go up. It's crazy. And the people, again, working people who have ACA Marketplace coverage, because not everybody has a job that offers insurance, right? Millions of people get their insurance through the Marketplace. We're going to see, as a result of this bill, those premiums shoot through the roof, right? For a 40-year-old making 40 grand, right, who's on like a pretty generous gold Marketplace plan, if they want to save money and switch to silver, they're going to be spending $6,000 a year in annual costs, right? If you're a 30-year-old couple making $64,000 a year, and you're on like the cheapest plan, which is a high deductible bronze plan, that plan is going to cost you an extra $3,500 a year. I mean, it's great. And these are working people. Like, you have to be making an income. You have to be earning an income in order to qualify for a tax credit to buy coverage on the exchange.
No, it's crazy. This whole system is crazy. It's, you know, we're talking a lot in the public space about, you know, efficiency. The healthcare industry is, in my view, one of the most inefficient, simply because of this component of it. The fact that we're going to try and figure out who's going to either pay or not pay, or how we can shift it off to somewhere else, or how the private sector can keep you healthy just long enough to get you on Medicare so you're someone else's problem. It's really a screwy, convoluted system that everybody's angry with, and yet we can't seem to fix.
Yeah, I think that's right. And then, you know, for folks on Medicare, as, you know, I mentioned before, many of them are going to see cost increases as a result of this bill, too, because they're, I mean, again, healthcare in this country is very complicated. The system we have is not the most intuitive. There are many different doorways you can go through to get coverage, Medicare being one of them. For people who are on Medicare, so this is mostly, you know, seniors and some disabled folks, right? When they are living on very, very, very low incomes, like we're talking 100% of the poverty line, like very low incomes, they qualify for extra help. They qualify for savings programs that help pay their premiums, that pay their out-of-pocket costs, that more or less turn Medicare into a zero-cost program for them, minus like a little bit of money for prescription drugs. And this bill has a provision in it that would make it harder for people to actually access those savings programs. And CBO, again, nonpartisan, Congressional Budget Office, they deliver information and advise Congress. They estimate 1.3 million Medicare beneficiaries are gonna lose that coverage. Those folks would be devastated by increased costs. Like in our analysis, as an example, right? Like a couple on Medicare, a couple earning $21,000 a year, jointly, right? So the two of them are living on a $20,000 a year annual income. Their costs could go up by $8,300 in out-of-pocket costs if they can't access the savings program that they are eligible for, right? That would be horrifying, right? So I don't understand why for that provision in particular, right? When you have the president saying, we're not touching Medicare, like this does. We knew that out of the House bill, and the Senate bill kept that language in. I mean, I don't understand it.
No, it's crazy. But here's my problem. I recently, these last 9 months, as my audience knows, my wife had a near fatal motorcycle accident. We have consumed an awful lot of healthcare daily. In fact, you know, I've got a stack of bills we're approaching $5 million in billed healthcare. Now my insurance paid about 1.3, 1.4 million of that. But billed healthcare, about $5 million. So where my mind immediately goes is, if she didn't have insurance and there's no Medicaid to help cover some of those costs, are we going to let her die? Is that what we're willing to do yet? And I fear we're getting to that point. But if we're not, who pays that $5 million? Because they're not going to take that discount. They're then going to say, we want all that $5 million because we know we're not getting some here, there, and other places. It's just going to jack up everybody's costs. It's just such a crazy system.
Yeah, I mean, I feel the same way. And, you know, a lot of folks, I think, misunderstand what people have access to with respect to healthcare, right? Like they think, well, if you show up at the emergency room, they have to take care of you. Like, that's the law. Question about like what will be required, you know, with respect to abortion care, reproductive health access. That's a separate conversation. But, you know, generally, what EMTALA, the federal law that requires treatment during medical emergencies for any facility that takes federal dollars, just like every hospital in America, all they have to do is like stabilize you, right? If you've got an ongoing, they're not going to be responsible for like ongoing cancer care treatment. They're not going to do that. And it's very hard to find a provider that's willing to provide like full-on charity care. My dad had a cancer diagnosis before he was insured, and we were able to get through like a payment program before he found an ACA plan. But it's very, very challenging. And on top of like all of these changes we've just talked about, something we haven't discussed yet is there is another change in this bill that would actually force states to impose cost sharing, like co-pays and deductibles, on low-income Medicaid enrollees, right? And not only that, but the language in the bill says the providers can turn patients away if they can't afford to pay those co-pays. And those co-pays, they said, at like 5% of your income, like toward the end of the year. I mean, that's a lot of money when you're making $15,000 before taxes, right? So I do worry about what it's going to mean for people's ongoing care needs. I mean, sure, if you fall, you get hit by a bus, like you can walk into an emergency room and they can make sure you don't die, then you're going to get a crazy bill at the end of the day that you're not going to be able to afford. That's going to jeopardize your credit history and put you in extenuating medical debt. But then beyond that, there's no obligation for providers to treat you if you can't pay.
It's just one of these things where you just go, I don't know, man. I hear the party of Christian values and the party of family values, the pro-life party tell me how much the sanctity of life, how much they believe in all this stuff and how religious they are. And yet this seems to me to be immoral. It seems to be uncaring. It seems me to be just frustrating and anger. And I don't think this is who we are yet. I fear we're getting there. I've had some moments where some people in the care economy have been less than compassionate. But, you know, I feel if we allow this to happen, that uncaring, uncompassionate, that evil just takes us over.
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty breathtaking to see Dr. Oz, right, who's the administrator for the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. This man is in charge of the largest insurer in the country, actually defend work requirements by using the phrase, like, get out there and prove you matter, right? Like, that's not even edited, right? Like, that's verbatim what came out of the mouth of our CMS administrator, that you should be proving you matter. That's like, I don't know what it takes to, like, the mental gymnastics it takes a person to be able to say something like that, or to say something like, you know, not everybody deserves to have health insurance. I think, okay, well, who deserves to have chemotherapy when they have cancer? Like,
look, I've been saying for
the
years.
The arbiter of that conversation.
No, I've been saying for years, the people who are against the ACA, the people who are against Medicare for All, the people who are against some form of national insurance program, they want to move this country in a direction of pay or die. Either you can afford it, either you can afford to live, or you cannot. Constitution, you know, founding country, you know, all values of the country, that stuff be damn, pay or die. Either you have the money, either you're worth something, or you're not. And I fear this is the kind of stuff that continues to move us in that direction. And for people like me who right now have the best insurance you're ever going to get, and I feel fairly secure in what I have, we don't know what tomorrow brings us. Tragedy could come at any moment, and to have something of a safety net to make sure that we don't have to pay or die, I think is kind of important. It's kind of an important value in a country that claims to be so religious and so good and righteous.
Yeah, I mean, I would just agree with you. And I want to just say, you know, there's a legitimate debate to be had about how you structure a healthcare system,
sure,
right? And like what insurance should look like in America. Our system's not great. It's got like, it's in real significant need of reform. But the way to do that isn't to just rip coverage away from 16 million people.
So let me ask you this then, real quick.
In order to pay for tax cuts.
Right. So, well, that's the other part of this. That's the real evil in this. But let's say this is the best thing that ever happened. Because one of the things that I said back on election night is, well, the country has decided Trump is the direction. Project 2025 is the direction. All of the horrible that we were talking about in 2024, that's going to happen. And it's happening. And I said that night, the solutions for our future will come out of the suffering due to their savagery. This is part of that savagery. There will be people who suffer. There will be people who die because of this. But out of that, I do believe that we're going to wake up. I hope. We saw, you know, millions of people in the streets. The hope is we organize and then get to somewhere better. But I just hate the fact that we got to go through the suffering that's coming.
Yeah, and it's important for us to remember, right, the bill itself, the provisions of the bill are wildly unpopular. When people understand what's in the bill, people who are aware that it exists, they don't support it. They're not supportive of the direction that this is moving us into. What I worry about is people don't even know that this is happening. There's so much chaos coming out of the White House and Washington in general. Wars, like, you know, sending the National Guard and the Marines to go arrest citizens, like all sorts of crazy stuff. And, you know, when I look at my local news in South, like where I grew up in South Florida, and when I look at, you know, the local news in New Jersey, they're not really covering this. If you're like an average person who's not inside the Beltway, who's not politically connected, you have no idea that this debate is even happening. And that's what's most frustrating to me. Like, how do we get it to break through?
Yeah, and that's where the Democrats, you know, maybe if we had a functional party, an opposition party who, you know, went out and said things and held press conferences and went out into red districts in rural areas and held hearings, as I've been suggesting for quite some time. Maybe if we did some of that education, maybe if we held some rallies and some press events to get local news, maybe you're right. Maybe we would. If we had a functional opposition party, maybe. But here's the thing. The reason I keep saying go find a rural district is this is going to overwhelmingly harm rural districts across this country. Because as I understand, some 300 plus hospitals across the country will be closing down, and in the rural poor areas.
Yeah. I mean, as you correctly point out, there's about 300 hospitals, rural hospitals in this country that are already at immediate risk of closure. Their finances are so bad that today, right, they could close. They could close at any time. So if you imagine you're the CEO of one of those hospitals, you could be faced with an influx of patients who all of a sudden have no insurance reimbursement. That could really tip the scales and force you into closure. That's very scary. And yeah, I mean, rural areas tend to rely pretty heavily on Medicaid. Rural areas are also places where you don't necessarily make up the difference when all of a sudden, you know, overnight, you've got a tremendous loss in insurance coverage. We've only been talking about the health components of this bill. There are many other components in this bill, including changes to food assistance programs that would really hit grocery businesses, grocers, that would harm families living in rural areas that help that depend on government assistance to help them feed their families. This is like a grab bag of awful policies that are, it's really going to hurt low and middle income families.
And especially in rural areas. And look, part of my thought is, and this is horrible to say it, I know I'm going to get angry emails, but you know what? If you can afford a red hat, you can get that Trump t-shirt. Maybe you can afford to buy your own health care and your own food. If I'm just using Republican pull yourself up or pull your don your cap or whatever logic, because it's the same kind of thing. But Andrew,
so except they don't, I mean, Republican voters want, they don't want the Medicaid program to be cut. They don't. But yeah, but here we are.
Yeah, well, they put this guy here. Andrea, I appreciate the time. I would say good stuff. It's not. This is all terrible. It's all bad. And we're going to need to be calling our representatives. We should be raising a stink, maybe getting out in the streets. Maybe we've got a couple million people out in the street to talk about this. That'd be good. But yeah. Andrea Dukas, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
She's Vice President of Health Policy there at the Center for American Progress. Check out their most recent piece on how the House Republican Big Beautiful Bill is going to make healthcare more expensive for all of us. You can find that at AmericanProgress.org. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Right back after this. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1865. That was the day that 2,000 Union soldiers marched into Galveston, Texas. With them, they carried the news that those enslaved were now free. The Confederate General Robert E. Lee had actually surrendered more than 2 months earlier. Why then was there a delay in delivering the news of emancipation to Texas? It might have been that there were not enough federal troops to enforce the order. It has also been speculated that freedom was postponed to allow enough time for the enslaved workforce to harvest one last crop of cotton before freedom. Whatever the reason, General Order No. 3 finally was delivered. It read, quote, "The people of Texas are informed that in accordance with a proclamation of the Executive of the United States, all slaves are free. This involves an absolute equality of rights and rights of property between former masters and slaves. And the connection existing between them becomes that between employer and free laborer. On hearing of the news, the newly freed people celebrated. The next year, they celebrated again in a holiday that became known as Juneteenth. In the years that followed, the holiday spread to other cities. But in the segregated South, black residents were often barred from holding Juneteenth events on public land. That is why, in 1872, several black men in Houston purchased property and established Emancipation Park as a space to hold the celebration. In 1980, Texas became the first state to formally recognize Juneteenth. Today, this holiday is celebrated in black neighborhoods across the country, with gatherings, barbecues, songs, and remembrances of the fight for freedom. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Have you been following the Trump mobile situation? Evidently, we're going to have a new cell phones. Trump mobile. launched on Monday. Touted as American-made. And American-made phones. And on Monday, what happened Monday? They pulled the map of Trump Mobile because it still said Gulf of Mexico down in that little body of water that's known as the Gulf of Mexico. Yeah, there was that. And the folks over at The Verge, they were looking at the maker of Trump's phone. And interestingly enough, they found, you know, several models somewhat close, quite similar, in fact, to the ones that are made in China. And look, we know, you know, Trump's history of producing things in China and then selling them here. I don't foresee that changing. But hey, you know, for the you got to give the guy credit. He knows how to fleece a flock, and good on them. I say, you know, if you bought the red hat, you might, and if you bought those $400 spray painted tennis shoes, you might as well get the phone. It's complete ensemble. Complete ensemble. Also, this should make my red hat friends very happy. Nippon Steel has finalized its deal to own 100% of U.S. Steel. So that means that the iconic American symbol of productivity and production, of the arsenal of democracy, if you will, well, it's probably going to be owned by a Japanese company. And why not? There's some interesting things in there. I'm waiting to see what the absolute details are and if what I'm hearing is true. But ultimately, there was a U.S. company that wanted to buy it. And I know. You're just being anti-China. Well, here's the thing. China's making a pitch for its currency to be part of the global currency to undermine and weaken the dollar's primacy, which, you know, I have some of my red hat friends who think that's a good idea. Again, not so sure I want China in that mix, but here we are. And finally, our Supreme Court should make the red hats all tingly in the panties. They sided 6-3 with a case that came out of Tennessee and Tennessee's ban on gender-affirming care for minors. And look, I've been very, very upfront about this. I think that should be really hard to do. I don't think parents should just be able to go, I think we're going to, but I don't want government regulating that. I don't want government, and this is where I thought I had my red hats with me. I don't want government being the decider in that. I want families, doctors, actual professionals, not politicians. And this is where, you know, the weird thing is I thought conservatives were anti-government, but here it is. You've got government over 26, I guess 26 states have similar laws. The Supreme Court has now upheld it 6-3, and we know the 6, we know the 3. No surprise here at all. Now, can we get rid of this issue? I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. If you miss any portion of the program, grab the podcast, wherever you get your favorite podcast. You'll find ours. And as always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. At rick@thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Soaring high above La Crosse, this is Eagle 1490 AM WLCX La Crosse, and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packard. Israel says it struck dozens of military targets in Tehran and around Iran overnight. Meanwhile, Iranian missiles hitting Israel, including a hospital in Beersheba, causing extensive damage. ABC's Ian Pannell is in Tel Aviv.
Now, the Iranians deny that they targeted the hospital. They said they were targeting Israeli military facilities. But we visited the site. We saw the damage. One of the wings of the hospital took a direct hit from this ballistic missile. The front facade of the building had all the windows blown out. You could see extensive structural damage.
The White House saying President Trump will make a decision on potential U.S. strikes on Iran within the next 2 weeks. A group of protesters gathered at Dodger Stadium in Los Angeles Thursday after the Dodgers